when it waddles like a duck, quacks like a duck, swims like a duck, and looks like a duck, it's quite likely to be a duck.
Bringing you the latest case law updates on the legal aspects of law enforcement. This is Broadcast Blue.
Hello, and welcome to this edition of Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar. I'm your host, Bruce Allen Barnard. This week, I'm coming to you from beautiful Amelia Island, Florida, and I'm so delighted that you have joined me for this week's episode. Each week, I bring you a legal update by way of my case of the week. If you're new to the program, there's three different ways that you can participate, either attending live via webinar, listening to the podcast, or watching the videos on our Vimeo channel. You can find out more about all of that at www.broadcast.blue. Special shouts this week to the National Park Service in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I'll see you in a week. And also to my friends and former colleagues in the legal division at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in beautiful Glencoe, Georgia. This week's case of the week I call the case of the ducky deal. Let's get to it. The case I've selected for the case of the week this week is United States versus Flores. This case comes to us from the First Circuit, and the opinion is dated the 25th of April of 2018. Let's take a look at the facts in this case. This is yet another drug case from the District of Maine. In fact, it involves a couple of law enforcement officers that we've heard before in some cases that I've covered as case of the week here on Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar. The facts in this particular case took place in Brunswick, Maine, and like many drug cases up there, it started with a DEA task force. One of the DEA task force members told Maine Trooper Pappas, who was assigned to the task force, that he had heard from a reliable informant that a group of New Yorkers were selling cocaine out of the Fairfield Inn in Brunswick, Maine. If you're joining either live in the webinar or on the video, you actually see photographs of the Fairfield Inn in Brunswick, Maine on your screen right now. The informant that provided this information to the DEA task force member did not have firsthand knowledge of the drug trafficking enterprise, but he had a history of providing dependable information and had participated in a number of cases. So Trooper Pappas and another law enforcement officer drove to the Fairfield Inn. They obtained a guest registry from the hotel staff and inquired whether any of the rooms had been paid for in cash, because Trooper Pappas and the DEA task force members know that this is often the case with criminal activity, because it allows them to pay for the room and avoid a paper trail with a charge card. And when he asked this question, he learned that of the 38 occupied rooms in the hotel at that time, only one, room 131, had been rented for cash. And so Trooper Pappas walked around the hotel grounds, noticing, as you can see on the screen if you're watching the video, that room 131 was one of the most easterly rooms. Its windows faced the parking lot, and it had an exit. It was close to an exit that was relatively private there at the end of the hotel, the kind that you have to have your key card to get in and out of. It provides exits other than the main entrance, so over there on that end. The two officers then went to talk to the front desk manager, and as soon as they approached her, she told them that she suspected that they were there to investigate room 131, and she was unprompted when she said that. As soon as they walked up, she kind of volunteered that information. And so she thought something was up out of that room. She said the room had been rented by a person who listed a New York address, and it was occupied by a group of men and women. And she described one of the guests as being an overweight or obese black male. She also told them that an unusual number of visitors had been coming and going on a frequent basis to and from the room. So they decided to set up surveillance in a neighboring room right next door of room 132. Around 5 in the afternoon, Trooper Pappas observed a vehicle pull into the parking spot that was directly adjacent to the room that they were in, and so he could see from the room what was happening in the car. And a man was driving, a second man was in the front passenger seat. And then an obese black male, roughly matching the description that was provided by the front desk manager, approached the car and got into the back seat. And it turns out this person is the defendant in this case, Flores. Trooper Pappas saw this man shift his weight in the vehicle as if he was reaching for something. He then saw the man make an exchange of something. Didn't know what it was, but there was some type of an exchange that took place with the person in the front seat. And after the exchange, Pappas saw the defendant counting money in the back seat and then exit the car. Now, this entire interaction only took about half a minute, 20 to 30 seconds. Based on his training and experience, Trooper Pappas believed that what he had witnessed was a hand-to-hand drug transaction and that the defendant had the money from this transaction and quite possibly additional drugs on him at that point in time. Trooper Pappas then walked outside through that door and saw the defendant near that exit at the eastern end of the hotel, and he noticed the defendant was smoking marijuana. Trooper Pappas went and got his fellow officer and then came back out to where the defendant was. They identified themselves as law enforcement officers, and then they detained the defendant and handcuffed him. The officers then proceeded to ask him questions. Although they didn't give him, there was no Miranda warnings that took place at this point. They started asking him questions where he'd been from, where he had come from. They learned that he was from New York, and he was staying in room 131. And when they searched him, it disclosed that he was carrying two cell phones, a key card, an identification card, and cash. The officers then brought the defendant into the hotel, and they neared room 131. As they get closer to this room, they think that they hear voices inside. And so they take the defendant's key card that they've taken from him, and using the key card, they enter the room. They open the door and they entered the room. And once inside, they determined that the voices were coming from the television set. The room was unoccupied, and the voices they heard were coming from the TV. They performed a security sweep, during which they observed, among other things, some cash in a mason jar containing marijuana. Pappas testified that during the entry, the officer simply glanced around and did not search the room for drugs or weapons. So now at this point, the officers start to Mirandize the defendant. And while the rights were being recited, a woman knocked on the door there at room 131 and explained that she was sent there by some people from New York to check on the defendant. Well, Trooper Pappas escorted her to room 132 and interviewed her there. He asked her for her cell phone, which she gave to him, and then he checked it. And while he was going through her cell phone, he saw drug-related messages and confronted her about these messages. And then she tried unsuccessfully to retrieve the cell phone. And as she's trying to get her phone back from him, he handcuffs her. Trooper Pappas then called for additional support. They proceeded to complete the Miranda warnings to the defendant. They asked the defendant for permission to search room 131, and he denied them consent to search the room. And so what they did was apply for a warrant. They kept the defendant in the hotel room in 131, inside the room, while the warrant application was taking place. The woman who had been detained provided a statement that was also included in the warrant application, and they took it to a state court judge. He reviewed the application and issued the warrant, and they went back and searched the room under the warrant, and they found two bottles of cocaine, approximately 200 baggies, a digital scale, and they also retrieved from the defendant himself a bottle containing heroin and crack cocaine. As a result of these seizures, they sought and obtained from the grand jury an indictment charging Flores with possessing controlled substance with the intent to distribute. The defendant moved to suppress the fruits of what he argued was his illegal arrest, as well as all the evidence from his hotel room. The district court held an evidentiary hearing at which Trooper Pappas, the front desk manager, and the front seat passenger who had purchased the drugs from the defendant in the parking lot, they all appeared as witnesses. Following the hearing, the district court granted the motion to suppress in part and denied in part. The court found that the defendant's detention outside the hotel room amounted to a de facto arrest, and that this de facto arrest was supported by probable cause. The court also ruled that the defendant's pre-Miranda statements should be suppressed. If what had happened was a de facto arrest, then that would be arrest-like custody that would trigger Miranda. And since he was not Mirandized in the beginning, the district court held that his pre-Miranda statements should be suppressed. And the court also assumed, for argument's sake, that the entry into the room, the initial entry into 131 before they had a warrant, was a violation of Flores' Fourth Amendment rights. And the subsequent search under the warrant was valid. It wasn't invalidated as a result of this this Fourth Amendment violation because of the independent source doctrine. And so the district court declined to suppress the evidence seized during that search under this independent source doctrine. The district court accepted Flores's conditional guilty plea, and he was sentenced to serve 30 months in prison. This appeal then followed. So there are two issues on appeal here, and what the defense attorney's doing is playing those Fourth Amendment dominoes. If he wins on either one of these issues, he's going to win on the suppression of the evidence. So he gets two bites of the apple here, trying to get the evidence excluded. The first argument is that there was no probable cause to arrest the defendant in the parking lot, so the whole thing was set off by an unlawful seizure, which would have been the very first domino in the chain of Fourth Amendment dominoes. So the first issue is, did the officer have sufficient probable cause to arrest the defendant in the parking lot to begin with? That's our first issue. The second issue is regarding the search under the warrant, the warrant-backed search. Was this warrant-backed search tainted by the earlier warrantless entry and therefore unconstitutional? Now, remember, the district court assumed that the initial entry was unlawful and that it was a violation of the Fourth Amendment. And we can't have a warrant validly exercised that's based on a Fourth Amendment violation. And we learned this and we're reminded of this in the Florida versus Jardines decision from the United States Supreme Court a while back. So in this second issue, the court is going to have to determine whether or not the district court properly applied the independent source doctrine to allow the evidence to come in, even though the earlier search was unconstitutional. So let's take a look at each of these two issues in turn. We'll start with the first issue. Issue number one, did the officer have sufficient probable cause to arrest the defendant in the parking lot? As you know, the Fourth Amendment guarantees a person's right to be secure in his person, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures in those, what we call those four constitutionally protected areas. And when we're talking about arrest, we're focusing on that first one, on the actual person. Now, a person can be seized without being arrested, but to be sure, an arrest is what the judge referred to in this case, Judge Selye referred to as the quintessential seizure of a person. And so to arrest someone, it has to be reasonable under the circumstances. An arrest is reasonable if the officer has probable cause to believe that a person has committed a criminal offense in his presence. Now, in this case, the officers didn't say you're under arrest, but that doesn't have to happen for an arrest to take place. A de facto arrest occurs when a reasonable man in the suspect's position would have understood his situation in the circumstances to be tantamount to being under arrest. So in other words, would a reasonable person believe that they were being placed under arrest under all of these circumstances at the time? The district court had determined that a de facto arrest had taken place, and the government did not challenge that on appeal. So the validity of the whole detention is going to be determined by whether the officers had probable cause to arrest the defendant at that time. But what exactly is probable cause? You know, the courts have struggled with that for years, struggled with trying to come up with some type of definitive and easy explanation, but it's just not simple. You have to look at the totality of the circumstances. The court says it's based on this totality, which means these decisions are very fact-driven, and no two cases are identical, which makes it even more difficult to determine in close situations exactly when probable cause exists and when it doesn't. But if for this particular case, the court said probable cause exists when an officer acting upon apparently trustworthy information reasonably can conclude that a crime has been or is about to be committed and that the suspect is implicated in this crime. You might recall in Illinois versus Gates, the United States Supreme Court said probable cause is a fluid concept and is not readily or even usefully reduced to a neat set of legal rules. It requires only a probability or substantial chance of criminal activity and not an actual showing of such activity. In Maryland versus Pringle, the court said, in considering whether an officer had probable cause for an arrest, we examine the events leading up to the arrest and then decide whether these historical facts, viewed from the standpoint of an objectively reasonable police officer, amount to probable cause. So the court then took a look at the facts that were in place, because when suspected criminality gives coherence to such historical events, a finding of probable cause is often supportable. And they looked at the facts that they had, the facts that the officer had at the time of the de facto arrest. First, Trooper Pappas came to the Fairfield Inn based on a tip that was provided by the DEA. The DEA had indicated that it was reliable, that the person who provided it was reliable, so Pappas could reasonably believe that it was reliable. And this tip said a group of people from New York were selling drugs from that hotel. And then the tip was corroborated partly upon arriving at the hotel. He learned there was only one room that was paid for in cash, and that's something that's likely to be the case for any room associated with criminal activity, and it was registered to a New York address. Furthermore, the front desk manager provided a physical description of the guest staying in that room. That was room 131. She noted that the guest received an unusual number of visitors and that they had moved to a ground level room closer to an exit door, which also tended to corroborate the tip. Then Pappas went and observed. He witnessed the defendant in this case. He had a physical description that roughly matched the one provided by the front desk manager. Saw this person take part in an interaction that appeared to him to be a hand-to-hand drug buy. It was consistent with a hand-to-hand drug buy. And the interaction transpired in a vehicle in the hotel parking lot. And the defendant could be seen shifting his weight in the back seat to withdraw something from a pocket. And then some type of exchange took place with the person in the front seat, and immediately after that, the defendant Flores began counting money that apparently he had received. This whole thing took place in less than half a minute, and right after that, Trooper Pappas saw the appellant out in the parking lot smoking marijuana. Now, if you're a Brown Bag Wednesday webinar veteran, you know that I absolutely enjoy reading decisions that were written by Judge Bruce Selya up there in the First Circuit. And this case is written by Judge Selya, and he has some interesting quotes, including the quote that this whole podcast started with. But in the decision, he notes, the whole is sometimes greater than the sum of the parts. And the court ruled that given the totality of the circumstances, especially the fact that Pappas witnessed what he reasonably believed to be a hand-to-hand drug buy, the court concluded that probable cause existed to arrest the appellant. Now, what the defense attempted to do in its argument was to provide innocent explanations for every single one of these facts that are taken in the totality of the circumstances. For example, they said that it's not infrequent, not uncommon for people to use cash to pay for a hotel room, even if they're not dealing drugs, and that Trooper Pappas did not actually see drugs that were exchanged, and that the smoking of marijuana was consistent with personal use. And in Maine, the significance of this is that a couple years ago in Maine, they amended the state constitution to allow for the legality of personal use in the state of Maine. So what the defense is trying to do, what is what the court referred to as a divide and conquer approach, show that there are innocent explanations for every single one of the facts that are being used to determine probable cause. But the First Circuit wasn't having it, and they noted the Westby decision, the Supreme Court decision in Westby that was issued earlier this year, and the Supreme Court held that it was an error to identify innocent explanations in isolation because the divide and conquer approach is improper. And that's not what probable cause is all about. It doesn't matter that there are innocent explanations for each of these specific actions. When you take them in the aggregate, the whole is sometimes greater than the sum of the parts. And that's what happens with the totality of the circumstances. And that does not change the analysis, the fact that each of these facts individually might have an innocent explanation. Their cumulative effect is very powerful, and the court said it solidly supports a double-edged inference that a crime was being committed and that the defendant was the one committing it. This is where Judge Selya said, when it waddles like a duck, quacks like a duck, swims like a duck, and looks like a duck, it's quite likely to be a duck, and the probable cause was determined to exist. having determined that sufficient probable cause existed to arrest the defendant in the parking lot, let's move on to the second issue now. Was the warrant back searched tainted by the earlier warrantless entry and therefore unconstitutional? Back in 1914, in a very famous Supreme Court decision, Weeks versus United States, the Supreme Court created what became known as the exclusionary rule. And under this rule, evidence that is taken in violation of the Fourth Amendment may be excluded. Now, the purpose of the exclusionary rule is to deter police misconduct. It's not an automatic. Just because a Fourth Amendment violation has occurred doesn't necessarily mean that that the evidence will be excluded under this exclusionary rule. There are exceptions to the imposition of the rule. There are exceptions to situations where the rule will not be applied, even though a Fourth Amendment violation has occurred. And one of these exceptions is called the independent source doctrine. And this independent source doctrine recognizes that the interest of society in deterring unlawful police conduct and the public interest in having juries receive all the probative evidence of a crime are properly balanced by putting the police in the same, not worse, position than they would have been in if no police error or misconduct had occurred. Now, this is a quote from a Supreme Court decision back in 1984 called Nix versus Williams. And the whole purpose of this is when the evidence or knowledge would have been obtained, even in the absence of the Fourth Amendment violation, they would have gotten to where they were through an independent method, a method independent of the taint, independent of the Fourth Amendment violation. In that situation, then the evidence will not be excluded, because excluding the evidence would put the police in a worse position and not the same position they would have been in had there been no misconduct. This is like a separate line of dominoes. Is there a separate line of dominoes that's going to get to the same point? And so if the evidence that was seized pursuant to the warrant would have been seized anyway, had there been enough to obtain a warrant without the taint, without any of the information that was obtained in violation of the Fourth Amendment, would they have been able to obtain a warrant? Would they have been able to establish probable cause? And would they still have done it? In other words, would they still have enough information to where they would have sought a warrant and obtained one? And that's the rule. We've talked about it before in the webinars here, this independent source doctrine coming up. And that's what the court is going to rely on in this second issue. Now, remember, the district court had already granted part of the appellant's motion to suppress. It excluded the statements that he made after the arrest, but before he was Mirandized. So the pre-Mirandized statements were suppressed. And on appeal, the government didn't challenge the unlawfulness of the intrusion. The appeal was based on the application of the independent source doctrine. And so that's what the First Circuit is going to do in this issue on appeal. And remember, the independent source doctrine is going to, you have to answer two questions. The first question, whether the officer's decision to seek a warrant was made independent of what they had learned during the unlawful entry in this case. And if so, whether the affidavit they submitted, when stripped of any of the knowledge obtained from the unlawful entry, still contained enough facts to support a finding of probable cause. So those are the two key questions that they're going to look at on appeal. The court started with the officer's decision to obtain a warrant. And the court noted that Trooper Pappas' testimony made it clear that once he detained the appellant, once he had arrested, de facto arrest of the appellant, the defendant Flores in this case, in the parking lot, that searching the room was the next obvious step. Trooper Pappas testified in the district court that his training and experience led him to believe that the hotel room was being used as the base for the drug trafficking operation. And since it was the defendant's room, it was likely to contain drugs, proceeds, and weapons. So the court ruled that the officers would have sought a warrant, even excluding the evidence and information that was gleaned as a result of the unlawful entry into room 131. So the second part of the independent source doctrine, the question is going to be whether the warrant affidavit contains sufficient facts to support probable cause, even after stripping it of the appellant's pre-Miranda statements and any knowledge they obtained during the initial warrantless entry into the room. In looking at the facts that existed up to the point of arrest, the court concluded that they had scant difficulty in concluding, after excising the offending facts from the affidavit, that it still contained more than enough information to support a finding that evidence of drug trafficking would likely be found in room 131. So the First Circuit affirmed the district court's decision in this case, and the conviction was upheld. Now, down here in the South, they're fond of saying an ugly win is better than a pretty loss. And so when you have a situation where, when you pretty much are giving up that there was a Fourth Amendment violation and you're fighting to keep the exclusionary rule from kicking in, you'll take it. If sometimes you have an ugly win where you have to use an exception to the exclusionary rule to keep the evidence in. And that's exactly what happened, exactly what the Assistant United States Attorney Benjamin Block did on appeal in this case, and did a good job at it. As you were listening to the facts in this case, you probably were noting a lot of questionable things that took place, things that could have resulted in evidence actually being excluded. And it's good to learn from the actions. Very active and proactive group of folks up there, and certainly don't want to be critical of the officers specifically involved in the case. At the end of the day, they took a drug dealer off the street. But it's important that there is subtle instruction that you can read. If you read between the lines and sometimes read the language that the court said, and then in a footnote in this opinion, let me share a quote with you from a footnote from Judge Selya. The quote, "We question whether it is sound practice for the police to hold a suspect in a room that they believe may contain evidence of a crime, especially where, as here, there is a readily available alternative. This appeal, however, does not require us to probe that point more deeply." And that's the end of the quote. And it's kind of a warning, a little bit of subtle instruction, almost as it to say, hey, look, this really could have gone another way. And on appeal, they didn't have to answer that question, that Fourth Amendment question. But if it would have had to been answered, it probably wouldn't have gone in their favor. And just kind of reminding you, going into the room and looking for evidence, when you've got an alternative to that, then don't do it. And remember, we have a saying we used to have when I was at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. We used to say that feds prefer warrants, and we're training the federal law enforcement officers. You know, we prefer that you operate in a warranted environment. There are a lot of situations to where you are operating, you have warrantless searches and seizures, and you're doing these under one of the many judicially recognized exceptions. And it's a valid tool, and you're doing what you need to be doing. But sometimes you don't have to. Sometimes you can secure an area and get a warrant and not have to go in. And it's kind of what they're alluding to, their subtle instruction in a footnote. And then once they had gone into the room to continue to hold the person in there, you know, they question whether it is a sound practice. A very subtle way of saying it's really not a good idea. So there are lessons to be learned from these cases, and I just wanted to kind of point out that footnote and let you know how the courts think, and remind you that you've got to line these dominoes up correctly. If you are relying on an exception to the exclusionary rule, think about this. If you are relying on an exception to the exclusionary rule, you are acknowledging that there has already been a Fourth Amendment violation. You're looking for a way out of the imposition of the penalty as a result of the violation that's already occurred. And it's always better not to have the violation in the first place. You don't want to be relying on the exceptions to the exclusionary rule. Thank you so much for joining me for this edition of Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday. webinar here on Broadcast Blue. Don't forget our website address, www.broadcast.blue. Our name is our website address. And so you can go to the website. You can find out information about how to join us live, how to watch the videos if you're not already doing that on our Brown Bag video channel on Vimeo. And also you can subscribe to the podcast on both iTunes and Google Play, and would sincerely appreciate it if you'd spread the word and get more folks to tune in. Obviously, kind of share the wealth. There will be no Brown Bag webinar next week. I will be in California the early part of the week and will not be able to produce a Brown Bag podcast for next week, and there won't be a video either. I will be heading to Philadelphia on Thursday, and on Friday I'll see you the National Park Service. I get to actually see the Liberty Bell and be doing training for the fine folks in the National Park Service up there in Philadelphia. Going to break my diet and have a Philly cheesesteak. So I'm going to be busy next week, and there won't be a Brown Bag, but I'll be back the week after that, and we'll have a really good case for you then. Make sure you check out the Blue Blog. You don't have to listen to podcasts all the time. I mean, we only have a couple cases, right, a month. We only do a few cases a month that we actually do a podcast for, but there are a lot of cases that come out. Check out the Blue Blog on broadcast.blue. It's where I provide a quick little summary with a link to the full download PDF version of the case for a lot of case law updates for law enforcement officers. That's your information network with the legal aspects of law enforcement, what the latest and greatest is on the legal aspects of law enforcement on broadcast.blue. And again, check out the Blue Blog. Thank you so much for what you do, and we'll see you again real soon. This presentation is provided for purely academic purposes. I'm fond of saying I'm a lawyer, but I'm not your lawyer. And what I mean by that is that I do not provide formal legal advice through these presentations. No part of this presentation is offered, nor should it be construed as legal advice. If you need formal legal advice regarding any part of this presentation or have legal questions, you should consult with your attorney.